Hello and welcome to Ed Talks, the podcast from King Edward School Birmingham and King Edward's High School for Girls, where I talk to old Edwardians from the boys and girls school about their time at school and what they did next. My name is Ben Anderson and I left school, went to Warwick University and left to become a radio producer in the UK's commercial radio industry. I was a breakfast show producer for many years and ended up running three stations for Capital FM up in Liverpool, where I live today. I love this podcast. I produce lots of podcasts with my business, Sound Rebel, but this is one of my absolute favourites because it is wonderful to talk to people who grew up in the same place that I did, albeit in a different time, and to see what they went on to do next. I'm a little bit nervous today, actually, because I'm joined, well, let me read this man's title to you. It's His Honour, Nicholas Cook, QC, formerly His Honour, Judge Nicholas Cook, QC, former senior circuit judge at the Central Criminal Court of England and Wales, otherwise known as the Old Bailey. Your Honour, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here and to remember times past, particularly in Birmingham, where I haven't lived since 1973, although I'm a fairly frequent visitor. So lots of nice memories from long, long ago.
Well, that's where I'd love to start. I mean, well, before I start, can I call you Nick?
Yes, of course. One of the reasons why I like doing things like this is they help me remove stereotypes about judges, hopefully, because I'm, to put it in the vernacular, an ordinary bloke. And I hate the idea of people judging you because of the job you've ended up doing. So, yeah, please call me Nick.
A quick side note, Nick. Of course, you've been called many titles throughout your career, Your Honour. My Lord, is that right, that you have to be called in once you're in the Central Court?
At the Central Criminal Court and as Recorder of Cardiff, when you're actually in court, you're called My Lord. Or, of course, My Lady if you're a woman, but My Lord in my case.
But I imagine that if you ever went back to school, despite being called My Lord for your day job, you'd still call the teachers Sir.
Correct.
Yes.
Some things never change. Yeah. They never change.
You left school in 1973, and that's obviously when you said you left Birmingham as well. Yeah. Take me back, first of all. Let's talk about Birmingham. What was the Birmingham like that you remember growing up as a teenager, going to King Edward School?
Okay. My mum and dad and me and my older brother, sadly no longer with us, who went to King Edward's Five Ways, lived in Swarthmore Road, which is on the borders between Selly Oak and Northfield. And I used to go to school by walking down the road and getting the 61, 62 or 63 bus along the Bristol Road to Edgbaston Park Road. And at the risk of sounding like somebody from a history book, it was threepence. I don't mean 3p, I mean three old pence, a brass threepenny bit to go on the bus to school. And it does seem a very long time ago. City centre of Birmingham was dirty in the sense that the buildings were blackened by the soot of the Industrial Revolution, really. It had that look to it. And you could still spot the areas of bombing. There was a car park and so on, which was clearly a bomb site. So I remember my mum and dad using when we went to town. And it was an old-fashioned sort of place in lots of ways, but quite exciting in a thriving city, very, very busy, just at the start of it becoming a more diverse society. We might turn to that a little bit later on with my trips around record shops and things. My interests in collecting records started when I was at school, the discery in Bromsgrove Street and trying to find deleted records in shops in Borsall Heath and Spark Hill and all sorts of areas of Birmingham. So happy days in many ways. And going to King Edward's, a little bit of a fish out of water, I suppose. I'm from a pretty ordinary background. A lot of the contemporaries I found there seem to come from perhaps more educated families, if I put it like that. So I remember being a little bit out of touch with the way people thought and acted. Much more used to football and Aston Villa and West Bromwich Albion and so on than rugby. I don't think I'd ever seen a rugby game other than brief snatches on the television before I went to King Edward's. So that was confusing. And you are only 11 when all this starts. So it's quite disorientating. You don't have the reference points. So that's a sort of introduction. I was in Shell B, the a teacher in charge of Shell B, always known by his military rank, which again dates these things, was Major Buttle. And I was interested in sport, despite the reference to rugby earlier. And I think when I was at King Edward's, I tried my hand at almost every sport you could possibly imagine. And the nature of the house system was such that you didn't have to be very good to compete at almost every sport that you can imagine, which I think was a great thing. I really enjoyed all of that and giving it a go. And it stood me in pretty good stead in later life as well.
Sport has played a big part in your later life, and we'll come on to that shortly. Just coming back to Birmingham at the time in the school, what were the kind of social and cultural issues of the day in the late 1960s, early 1970s?
Well, you have to answer that question on sort of two levels. The school itself, my memory at least, was fairly monocultural. Diversity hadn't kicked in King Edward's in those days. There were only a handful of boys from ethnic minorities. I hate calling people by their surnames, but you must have come across this before in other podcasts. I can actually remember his first name, so that's great. But the only black boy in my year was Andrew. His first name was Forbes. Now, I remember that, but it was the surname that came into my mind first. That's such a throwback. But I remember him. And I can't remember there being any tension about things like race in relations with him, but he may have a wholly different perspective. And there were a few boys higher up the school. I can remember Muna Mitra, a few years above me, and so on. But so it wasn't a very diverse community. On the other hand, a lot of people were, and I was one of them, so I can say that, interested in what was going on in the wider world. King Edward's was good for getting you interested in the wider world, about what was going on in America at the time. My time at school was contemporaneous with the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King and Medgar Evers and all those things in America, Southern States in particular, and Selma, Alabama, and all these things. Culturally, well, I was interested in English literature and things like that, so there were trips to Stratford and those types of things, and to the rep in town. So that's, I hope, an insight into my individual perspective about those things.
You mentioned the civil rights movement in America, and how in tune were you with that as a white man, a white teenager living in Birmingham in the UK? Was it on the agenda? Was it talked about in the classrooms? Was it in the newspapers? It's something that we look back on now as having huge cultural importance, of course, but did it feel like that at the time?
I think it did feel very important if you followed the news. Was it talked about all the time at school? No. There was a particular history teacher that I remember who was an influence on me. Again, I'm sure you often get these things in the podcasts. David Ganderton, I suspect his name's been mentioned on other occasions. And although I can't say I can remember specific conversations, he was the sort of teacher who would link things, developments that were going on in the world around us, which is a great feature of education. I think it's hugely important. And we're talking of a time that was before politicians, in one direction or another, started interesting themselves in trying to criticise teachers who might talk about anything that was in some way political. My own view is you can't teach history without talking about things that are in some way political. You can try and be balanced, and that's a good thing, but it's not actually very easy to be balanced about the civil rights movement in America if you're normal. So there was that. It was also something which interested me because right back for almost as long as I can remember, I was interested in the music of Black America. And so that led me into knowing quite a lot about that subject. That wasn't uncommon amongst white youth of lower middle class or working class origin during the years we are talking about. I wasn't unique, but it wasn't something which was permeating the school. They weren't things that everybody discussed. We're talking about a minority.
So when did the law start to become a feature of your thoughts?
Well, the answer to that is in probably the division, history division I was in. So lower sixth in more general speak. As I mentioned, I had an older brother. He was the first in our family to go to university, and he went off to read chemistry in London. And to the particular shock, I think, of my late father, he, having done a first degree, instead of going off and working for ICI, all the sort of thing that my father would have understood and appreciated, he went on to do a master's and indeed a PhD. And then he was, as I mentioned, considerably older than me. So I was watching this as a child, and this was in the 60s. And amongst his other activities was selling abstract art from the railings of one of the parks in London. And he'd acquired the trappings of hippie clothing and so on. My father, not terribly enamoured of this sort of world, and I am coming back to the point, which I think some of the current students at King Edward's will fully understand, that my father's reaction to this was that I could only go to university to read something which involved a qualification at the end and professional life and going into work, and that anything like my brother was to be avoided. Since I wasn't taking science A-levels, dentistry wasn't a possibility. So the law or accountancy were the options that I really got given by my parents. I'm not sad I did it, but they were very influential. You have to remember that the world of the 1970s, early 1970s, the extent of parental control on people was quite high. Certainly for people from my background, it was regarded that education was a very good thing. My mother and father were archetypally upwardly mobile people who valued education to a high degree, and that's great. But they saw it as a means to an end. I can remember, because I quite wanted to be an archaeologist or a historian, and simply being told I could read that sort of stuff in my spare time.
Do you think that came from, and please do tell me, Your Honour, to butt out if I'm getting too personal.
All right.
But do you think that came from a loving and supportive place, in the sense that they wanted you to have a better life than they'd had? Did it come from a selfish place, where they wanted to be able to say that their son was a barrister, a judge?
I think it was probably more the former than the latter, but I wouldn't rule out the latter. I have picked up in professional life lots of friends from Sikh community, Muslim community, Hindu community, and I've discussed these things with them, and they recognise the same sort of combination of the two points that you've mentioned, that I think in upwardly mobile societies, the mixture is quite common. They want to say to the neighbour or the family member, Nick's done well, he's a barrister. Nick's done well, he's a judge. On the other hand, they also remember what a struggle it's been, working long hours, etc. So my mother's father was a miner. So, you know, these things are different, aren't they? Your perspective is, it's great that he's got into King Edward's, love telling the relatives, that's fantastic. Gives you a passport to not doing the sort of work that historically my parents had done. They'd got on in their own lives. So this is the sort of, I think, the high watermark of social mobility of the way it used to be thought was in the 60s and 70s, and I'm a product of that. And King Edward's was part of it for me.
So the decision was made. You were going to go and study law.
Yep.
Were you always aiming for the top? Were you always aiming for the Old Bailey? The reason I ask you that is because we had Grace Gwynne on last series of Ed Talks.
Okay.
She is a couple of years younger than me, so late 20s. And she already knows that she would love to be a judge. She's got that in mind. She's doing what she's doing now because that is the final ambition. And I'm absolutely, by the way, convinced and sure that she's going to do it, and she's going to do it very quickly. Incredibly bright woman. Was that there for you, or was it a consequence of going and studying and learning more?
I think the fairest answer is to say yes, because somewhere deep in my personality, probably moulded by King Edward's, is if I'm going to do something, I'm going to try and win it. I have that ambitious streak. So inside, internally, I had the drive that I want to get as far as I can in the profession. Did I think I'd make it to being a judge? So on a good day, if I'd had a good day in court, perhaps. On a bad day, perhaps not. So I think more difficult. There have also been huge changes in the way in which people progress in the legal profession, which occurred in my own time. We could spend a whole podcast talking about those, but that also made it more difficult to think that even if you were deserving, that you would necessarily get on. So it's quite a long answer to what's a complicated question. So I was always going to try my best, always wanted to win the race if I entered it. So I wanted to get as far as I could get. Did I think I would? That's a harder question. I don't know, really.
I'd love to talk to you about the profession itself. I was watching one of your lectures, Bribery and Corruption in the City.
Okay.
And you were talking quite early on. You talk about, essentially, I think, red tape. You're talking about the two different versions of the judge, the lofty lawyer, the wise judge on the one hand, and on the other hand, the image of the lawyer as a plumber, as a technician. Yeah.
Well, that's born of a particular article, and you should always credit things where they're due. Unfortunately, I can't remember the distinguished academic who gave the lecture, which was then printed. It's a lecture which is hugely influential on me about the year after I left King Edward's, called Pericles and the Plumber. And if anybody's a budding lawyer and listening to the podcast, it's worth Googling and worth reading it. And that draws the contrast between lawyers as philosophers on the one side and as technicians, if we choose an appropriate synonym for the plumber in the context of the lecture. And it's been a constant battle, still current, over whether the job of a judge, for example, is to be a philosophic gentleman as opposed to being a technician, in other words, an applier of rules, or someone who should evaluate the rules and see how they might be applied to this person, but actually trying to do justice is a more amorphous concept. So I was always interested.
And you said in this lecture that the lofty lawyer, or the wise judge, is what you wanted to be, and that unfortunately it feels as if the job wasn't quite like that in many ways. Did you find that as the years progressed, it became more technician's work?
I did. That's absolutely right. Well done for watching the lecture. Very much on my mind at the moment. If we go to the end, or hopefully not the absolute end, but towards the end of my active career, because I'm retired as a judge now, I've just started doing a research degree part-time in Oxford. And one of the reasons for that is the extent to which I began to be dissatisfied with the inability to evaluate things from a blank sheet of paper, it having been substantially replaced for the judicial function. Talking now about criminal law, there are distinctions if you're doing something else, but that's what I ended up doing. The growth of specimen directions. So when I first started as a judge, I took enormous pride in, and I was very satisfied in my own mind, the Court of Appeal might have thought differently, but they didn't often, the way I crafted a summing up to a jury. And when I, as I did, occasionally sat as an additional judge in the Court of Appeal Criminal Division, I tried to go back to primary sources, and I tried to construct everything I did with, hopefully, using the best of my intellect and looking at the raw materials. Effectively, this was substantially replaced by the preparation of specimen directions, ever-increasing and, to some extent, constraining guidelines, meaning that you didn't need the sort of experience I had, and it was indeed not necessarily wise to start from scratch with directions. You were safer adopting something which had been through a committee and which was approved. Now, that's fine, and it has certain advantages in terms of diversity of recruitment and so on. And the system doesn't exist for my entertainment. But it has disadvantages if I be self-deprecating about me. If you're a frustrated academic, then at the level, and you were kind enough to say it was the top, but it's not the top. The top is the Supreme Court. There, you don't have that sort of problem, but I was never going to get to the Supreme Court. So the problem for me was that I was frustrated that I'd become more of an official and less of a philosopher judge. And so a time came when I thought I want to do something else. And I was lucky enough to be able to do so because I'd had a successful life in practice and the money didn't preclude it. So again, it's a long answer, but I hope it's of interest to the listeners.
I hope you don't mind me staying on the subject for a little while longer. Just I'm interested to find out where did these kind of guidelines and regulations come from? Was it politicians? Was it new governments coming in? Was it the system evaluating itself? Was it that things had gone wrong previously that couldn't go wrong again?
This falls into two categories, so we'll split them up. They both come from committees, so not directly politicians, and the committee selection, that's varied over the years, and one can no doubt write a monograph about it. I'm not an expert, but it's committees that draw these things up or delegate it to a particular senior judge who will draw them up. They'll be put out to some form of consultation. It's varied over the years. So with things like specimen directions, in other words, how you should sum up a case to a jury if the issue is self-defense, always hedged about with you should be careful to tailor this to the particular circumstances of the case, you get a specimen direction. Of course, people are discouraged from simply cutting and pasting and reading it out. You're supposed to apply your mind to it. But this is very different from, as I had to do when I first became a judge, working on your own variant, which you again would adapt and use as a sort of template, although that's putting it a bit too rigidly. So that's what happened in various incarnations. Books of specimen directions got issued. That's that side. In some ways, that causes you less of a problem in terms of feeling that you're doing justice than the position, always concentrating here on criminal law, with respect to sentencing, because sentencing is something which I'll illustrate it by something I was told when I did my first week sitting in with a judge when about 25 or more years ago, I'd been made a part-time judge. And the judge I was sitting in with, Judge Rutter, very experienced judge, obviously no longer with us, said to me, we were on first name terms, which in itself made me feel quite nervous because I, you know, you can imagine the scenario. I've just been a barrister. He's never called me by my first name before. So I've had a week of him calling me Nick, which is pleasant, but a bit disconcerting, like calling the teachers sir. So, and he said, one thing you must always remember is when you sentence a man or woman, you must be able to look them in the eye and say, you deserve what I'm going to do to you. Because, Nick, it's on your conscience. It's not on anybody else's. And that's what makes it a human system rather than an automatic system which doesn't have humanity. Now, that made a big impression on me. And you can understand that then when you get guidelines which say this should be 3 years, that should be 6 years, not the Court of Appeal reducing your sentence because it's too harsh, or as they increasingly are able to do, increasing it because it was too lenient, so they say. But you start from this guideline point. Now, they are described as guidelines and you can depart from it. But increasingly the learning has been, yes, but you can only depart from it if it's something which the guideline did not envisage. And that means you've got pretty little by way of scope. And for someone like me, that meant I was unhappy on occasions because I was doing things, to go back in time, which wouldn't have passed Judge Rutter's test. I couldn't look them in the eye and say, I think you deserve this. I'd have to be a little like Pontius Pilate and wring my hands and say, I don't want to do this and I wash my hands of it, but others have taken it out of my hands. So it's an ethical dilemma.
How difficult is it to be objective? Of course, it's your profession, so it's part of what you do and it's part of the training and the experience. But is it, it must be very difficult to separate your personal feelings and professional feelings in some areas, or is that, does that never come into it?
And it's a complex question. I'm not sure if we just focus on sentencing, but these things do arise in other cases. We just haven't got time to cover all the bases, but childcare cases, cases of compensation for serious personal injury, etc., these same issues, sort of issues arise. I'm not sure you should ever be, although others would disagree with me, completely objective, because you are dealing with human beings, and therefore you should be to some extent subjective. And if you're wholly objective, there is a danger of losing sight of the humanity of the people whose lives you're interfering with. So I think that is important. On the other hand, you can't be wholly subjective either. Certainly can't be irrationally subjective or subjective, incorporating your likes or dislikes of certain sorts of people. So you can't sentence people more severely because of their race, gender, class, rich, poor, etc. That's all impermissible. So it's a subjective and objective standard that has to be adopted. My concern, I think, would lie in the area to which you can have a creeping process of dehumanizing consequent upon taking matters off the individual's responsibility.
Do you take it home with you at the end of the day?
I was quite good at not taking it home with me. You've obviously researched me a bit. I have dealt with some terrible cases. I really have, you know, gang murders, horrific killings. And I've sat there and listened to the evidence of people who have seen things that no one should ever see. I'll illustrate, because you asked, you take it home. I could think of other things, but some of the memories would be with me forever. There's no doubt about that. Would I be able, though, to go to the football, go to the theatre, listen to music, whatever it might be that night, and not be unable to sleep? Yes, I would. I was always able to put it out of my mind. Part of the reason for that was I might not have been quite so able earlier in my career as a barrister, but I came across pretty dreadful things quite quickly. And if you couldn't cope with it and process it, you couldn't do it. And we're all made up differently, aren't we? And I was able to cope with it and process it. Anybody who's thinking of a career along the lines of mine, don't do it if you can't. And do keep up other interests. I think that's another change in the world, not what forced me to think again about my career very late in life. But it's easier, or it was easier rather, in the past to compartmentalize these things than it is now. And that applies to whatever area of law you might do. And the reason for that is new technology. You're always available. People send you emails all the time. Much more has to be dealt with in writing than at the start of my career. That may sound as if, well, why does that make a difference? Well, it makes a difference because in an oral system, you read all this, you absorb it, you make your notes, you make your speeches, you do that, you give your summing up. You've got to type it all out. Then it's a longer process of a different type. And certainly from my point of view, I feel sorry for those who can receive emails every hour of the day and night and have to respond, because you're unable, save with the greatest of difficulty, to really enjoy your night at the theatre. You know, when you get back, if you turn the computer on, and you probably got to, you're going to be assailed by this stuff, where it was easier for me to, when it was all input on paper, to forget it.
Hi, I'm Sana.
And I'm Betty, and we've been fundraising in support of the Assisted Places scheme across each school. What's that, you ask?
The Assisted Places scheme aims to provide access to excellence for all. So if you want to make a change,
start small and support the campaign. Thank you.
Please forgive my ignorance here. I'm a humble podcast producer and know very little about your line of work. I'm having a wonderful time asking you about it, I'm not going to lie.
Fine.
But it feels like the role of a barrister and the role of the judge, in obviously similar spheres, but they seem like two very different jobs. When you're a barrister, you are presenting one side of a case. When you're a judge, you're presiding on the whole thing. Does it feel like a huge leap or a huge change in terms of your the way that you are approaching your day-to-day working life? Does it feel like a different job, or is it just a progression on from what you've already
It definitely feels like a different job, and I think that would be true whatever area of law you practiced in. And for that reason, it's a good idea, in my opinion, that in our system, unlike most of the rest of the world, you start off as a part-time judge. So, for example, it's a good way of illustrating it, I think. The difference is you're only interested in your side, in winning, effectively, although we try not to talk of winning and losing. But you're only interested in representing the prosecution, because I did do that, or the defence, and those are the arguments. And the system works best if they're evenly balanced, and the judge and the jury hear both sides, and they reach a decision, having heard the best arguments that can be raised on either side, and that's how you look at it. It's very different when you're a judge. In a civil case, you're deciding the facts as well, so it's more onerous in some ways, because the jury does the facts in a criminal trial, and you're sort of the referee and dealing with the law and then the sentence at the end. So you're looking at it entirely differently. So yeah, they are two different jobs. And there's a sort of physical transition that emphasizes this when you first start sitting as a judge. So you, apart from when you'd gone in either for social reasons, which happened every now and again, or because there was something that had to be dealt with in confidence, which is rare, you'd never been in the judge's chambers, certainly hadn't been in there very much. So physically, you started entering through a different door. The staff were different to you. They were always quite nice to you, but they were different when you were the judge. You got to park in the judge's parking space. First time I did that, the chap responsible said, "You can't park there, that's the judge's space." And I had to say, being quite a young chap, "But I am the judge." And he said, "Oh, right, that's different." And that happened more than once. So it was a very common state of affairs. So you went in through a different door. Instead of going to the cafeteria and buying a cup of coffee in those days, the court usher would get you a cup of coffee. Everybody stood up when you went into the room. So there's an emphatic change of status. And you had to learn to shut up. I wasn't very good at this. But you had to learn that your role was no longer to do that. You should let this unfold in front of you. Easier and more important, actually, when it's a jury trial, because it's a bit obvious that it's not your job to do this. When it's a civil trial and you are the judge of the facts, you're more allowed to say, "Well, I'm sorry, I just don't accept that." You can't do that when there's a jury there. They might accept it, even if you think it's rubbish.
When I went from being a producer to becoming a managing editor in the radio industry, people bought me coffee. They didn't stand up when I walked into the room. They did bring me coffee. I missed being a producer. Did you ever feel that as a judge? Did you ever feel out of the action as such? That you said earlier that you like to win, and that might be something that came from your time at King Edward's. Suddenly you're not presenting the arguments anymore. You're listening to the arguments and presiding. Did you miss that element? Did you miss being in the thick of the action?
Hardly ever. Right. And
you'd lose the parking space.
Yeah, I'd lose the parking space. That's right. I I could have had a parking space at the Old Bailey, but in case people think you get a chauffeur and things like that, no, you don't. I used to go on the tube, so I had a parking space in Cardiff.
Speaking of Wales, you've recently been made an honorary fellow at Aberystwyth University. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And you've been incredibly busy since you've retired.
I have.
You're the chair of Fields and Trust Wales, is that right?
I am.
On the development board of Orpheus, which is a performing arts charity.
That's right.
What does your day look like now, kind of day to day?
Well, today's been fairly busy. I'll just give today and carrying through after I finish with you. Today's a busy day by my standards. I went to the gym this morning. I try to keep as fit as I can. I won't give you the kilograms or pounds, but I was proud of myself. All of this is a product, I'm sure, of being at King Edward's and the way in which you have to look at these things. I am now deadlifting and back squatting reps greater weights than I've ever done before. I only took to doing this in retirement, so that doesn't mean that much, but that's quite good. Then between 1 and 3, as part of the doctorate I've started, I have to attend lectures on legal research methodology. And some of this is repeating what I knew anyway, but a lot of it isn't, because academic law is a different discipline. So it was all very interesting. So I did that for 2 hours. I'm now talking to you. I have to finish in about 10 minutes because I've got to have something to eat. And then one of my friends is picking my wife and I up, and we're off to see Newport County at home to Carlisle United. So I have a full day today. Tomorrow I'm just going to be trying to do some work for my doctorate. So that's it. In between those things, I have been dealing with some Fields and Trust things. Anybody who's listening, if you want to support the charity Fields and Trust, well worth supporting it, providing security for long-term security for parks and playing fields, you know, all over the UK. I've just got responsibility for the Welsh bit. And we all know how important parks and playing fields are. And I've benefited, haven't I, from Eastern Road and Southfield and all the rest of it. Lucky old me. Some people don't have access to those facilities in the way we enjoyed it. And so that's, you know, another thing that comes from there. Performing arts, likewise, and people who suffer from a disability and involving them in the performing arts. You can easily see how that's pretty consistent with the King Edward's way of looking at the world, or should be. So, yeah, keeping busy.
And will you stop? Or do you have to keep busy?
Not in the foreseeable things. I knew I'd use this phrase, but it's die of service, not of rust, isn't it?
Is that from the school song?
It is.
Yes. No place for fop or idler.
That's right.
Nick, I'd like to thank you so much for your time today. I've really enjoyed talking to you. I find it fascinating learning about the people that you see in these positions of power. You can often forget that they are normal people who went to school,
yeah,
who went to university, studied. Because it's so far removed from what I know, there's almost a mystique around jobs like yours.
Yeah, and that can be, I think, counterproductive, because it's really important that the general public, and that's not intended to be a patronising form of words, understand that judges are ordinary people. And if we've lost, and I think we might have done, if we've lost a degree of social mobility, that's unfortunate. Because at the heart of a fair judicial system is actually that the people who become judges are a cross-section of society. Gender, ethnicity, social class and background all need to be represented in a way that broadly reflects society. And that's not easy to achieve. And if it fails a bit, I think we're all the losers.
I feel like we could probably talk about that for an hour.
We could. I do.
But as you know, I like to end this podcast asking everybody the same question. I gave you the heads up on it earlier. In terms of, if you could look back and look back at your early days, your formative years at King Edward School, what would you say is the characteristic that has served you best throughout your career?
Well, you did give me a warning about it. I think the fact that I was given a mindset which meant that I felt that if I wanted to achieve something, I could probably do it if I put my mind to it. And if I failed, then as long as I'd done my best, I shouldn't beat myself up about it. So I think those things. And I think that was part of the general education I received, part of the sports side of things as well. And it's stood me in very good stead. And even now, you see, it's because of that that I thought, although credit where credit is due, it was my wife who encouraged me to do it, but I went along with it because of the sort of thing we've talked about. That's why I thought even now, quite happy to try and get a doctorate from Oxford. You know, in some ways, that's not logical to want to do that when you're in your mid-60s. But I thought, well, I could do that if I wanted to. Yeah, it's given me a determination to do things, irrespective of whether the outside world might think it's beyond you.
Nick, Your Honour, Nicholas Cook, QC, thank you ever so much for your time today on Ed Talks.
You're welcome. Have a good evening.
thank you for listening to Ed Talks. I hope that you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you have, it would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on whatever app you're listening on, so you can keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave your feedback in the review section. If you're listening on a platform where you can't leave your comments, then please do email me with your feedback. My email address is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. If you would like to feature on this podcast as a guest, then please email Adelaide Bailey at the Development Office. Her email address is aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. That's aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. She's also the person to email with any news that you think should be featuring in Old Ed's publications, either in print or online. Finally, if you think a podcast would enhance the communications of your business, organisation or charity, then I'd love to talk to you about producing it. My email address again is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me again.